that's kind of a new.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. We have the first item on the agenda is Senate File 680, Senator Latz. And Senator Latz, first of all, let me, on the record, apologize that we've been bumping and bumping you and this list of bills because of the snowstorms. So thank you for accommodating us
it's
and for your
fault.
Understanding
that
we've bumped you around.
Thank you for hearing the bill, Madam Chair.
On the bill, Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, members, this bill proposes to reduce the out-of-pocket expenses for those individuals whose driving privileges have been revoked for driving under the influence of alcohol and when they seek reinstatement of their driving privileges. The first, maybe I should move the A3 amendment or ask member of the committee to move the A3 amendment to put the bill in the shape I wish.
Members have the A3 amendment.
It's in the packet.
Senator Limmer moves the A3 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author desires to be in.
So moved.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, when a person gets a DWI, their driving privileges are revoked, either as a result of the conviction for the DWI or under the implied consent law or both. If in the end that revocation remains on the record, or if they wish to get the driving privileges reinstated before a final determination is made about the long-term status of the driving privileges, they need to pay, by statute, a $680 reinstatement fee, plus the about $28.50 renewal fee. So it's about $700 for a person to get reinstated. It used to be in the 200s until, I think, 2003 when a bill was passed to increase on a graduated rate the numbers up to a total of $680. The practical impact of that, I believe, has been a lot of people who can't afford to reinstate their driving privileges and who desire to keep their jobs or otherwise take care of family and other needs and continue to drive, but this time without valid driving privileges, and I would submit often without valid insurance as well. In 2006, there were approximately 44,000 DUIs in the state of Minnesota. According to the Department of Public Safety, there were 29,000 reinstatements of driving privileges in Minnesota during the same time period. We can't get exact information because of the lengths of revocations vary, but there's a significant gap, probably of 10,000 to 15,000 individuals who were revoked for DUI but didn't get themselves reinstated. And I think one could legitimately surmise that the financial burden of doing so had a big reason for that. I know for a fact in Ramsey County that there are more driving after revocation charges than there are DUI charges or any other kind of traffic citation. I am told that the same is the case in Hennepin County. As a practical matter, people who can afford private attorneys can probably afford, even if there's some pain involved, to pay a reinstatement fee and keep their jobs and keep driving. But those individuals who qualify from an income standpoint for the public defender probably have a very significant barrier to getting their driving privileges reinstated. I think it's fair to surmise that many of them are out driving without valid driving privileges, and I think that is a public safety risk for all drivers on the road. If there's a reason that we want people to be licensed in Minnesota for public safety reasons, then we want them to be able to afford to get licensed in Minnesota for public safety reasons. I've been in contact with the public defenders, and some of them have told me that as much as 50% of their caseload are DARs. I had one public defender from Washington County tell me that this afternoon. So it is a very significant problem in the state of Minnesota. What this bill does is proposes to create an installment plan to make it more affordable for these people to get reinstated. The installment plan will be a 2-year installment plan. The original bill was 4 years, but the fiscal note that came back on that was too dramatic, I think, to be sustained in anyone's budget this year. So I'm proposing a 2-year installment plan that would be, there'd be some transitional costs, basically. In the long run, presumably, the same amount of dollars will come in, but in the short term, there would be a drop in the impact.
Senator Latz, is that the effect of the A3 amendment?
That's the effect of the A3 amendment. It's to change from 4 years to 2 years, the installment plan. And also the A3 amendment narrows the eligibility for this to those who qualify for public defender services. The original bill would have applied to anyone who had been revoked for a DUI and sought reinstatement. Now, that would have avoided the necessity of doing any kind of an income screening, but the Department of Finance, in consultation with the affected departments, concluded that probably, and I'm not sure where they got this number, but they said probably 75% of all people would take advantage of the installment plan, and that it would be a huge drop in the first year, and then, of course, a reduced drop in subsequent years as you spread that out over 4 years.
Members, the A3 amendment is the delete all amendment to the bill. Senator Latz, so you don't? Do you have a preliminary fiscal note on the A3 amendment?
We do not. I was told we couldn't officially ask for it until there's an amendment on. I think staff has made a request for a phantom fiscal note, which now can become an official request, I suppose.
Very good. Any questions? Senator Latz, do you have anybody here to testify on the bill?
Yes, Travis Schwantes, an assistant public defender in the 10th Judicial District, is here in support of the bill. I can represent to the committee that the Board of Public Defense supports this bill as well. I can also tell you that Hennepin County Sheriff Stanek submitted a statement to me by email indicating that he thought public policy should not make it impossible for people of modest means to get their lives back on track after committing a DUI. And that the current policy and costs regarding reinstatement fees for a revoked license stemming from a DUI should be looked at and perhaps amended to account for people of modest means. Public policy should not motivate people to drive without a license or insurance. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd ask Mr. Schwantes to testify.
Mr. Schwantes, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Travis Schwantes. I'm the managing attorney of the Public Defender's Office located in Stillwater. We have 14 lawyers in my office, and people get us to represent them by filling out an affidavit in court saying that they're financially unable to retain private counsel. The affidavit goes into an assessment of income, assets, real estate, whether they own a vehicle, if so, what type, whether they have any equity in that vehicle, whether they have any equity in their home. It's a pretty substantial undertaking. That affidavit is then reviewed by a judge, and a judge will then make the determination about whether somebody is financially eligible for our services. We end up representing anywhere from about 75 to 90% of defendants accused of crimes in my county, Washington County. What that means is that on a typical misdemeanor calendar, there may be one public defender handling about 30 cases between 1 o'clock and 4 o'clock or 1 o'clock and 5 o'clock on a given afternoon. If it's a misdemeanor calendar, if they're handling 30 cases, I'd say about 15 of them are going to be driving after revocation or driving after suspension type cases. And what typically happens on those cases is all 10 judges in our county want to make sure that people have an opportunity to get a valid driver's license. And so the case ends up getting continued for a period of time so that they can raise money to be able to do that. Oftentimes, a driving after revocation case takes 3, 6 to 9 months, and people either come back with their license valid or they don't. If their license is valid, the case is resolved in such a way that avoids further suspension or further revocations. If their license is not valid, and the state can prove the case or the defendant pleads guilty to driving after revocation, they end up getting a further suspension or revocation, which puts them further in the hole, and they oftentimes will get jail time. In fact, many counties, and I've worked in Washington County, which is primarily suburban. I've worked in urban counties, and I've worked in rural counties in the state of Minnesota. And most counties, after a certain period of time, have a formula. If you have one DAR, you get X number of days in jail. Two, it just multiplies from there. So people are doing jail time because they don't have money to get their license valid, and they're doing a lot of jail time. As far as the DUI goes, nobody's saying that they shouldn't already – people that are found guilty of a DUI, nobody's saying that they shouldn't receive the penalties that they already get. The jail time, the fines, the surcharge, law library fee, which is $72 in every case. They'll get a supervision fee in most counties for being on probation, which can range from $100 to $300. That's not waivable by the court. They'll get a chemical use assessment fee of $125 to look into whether they have an alcohol dependency issue. A lot of them are ordered to do random UAs, urinalyses for alcohol use. Those are $16 a time. All my clients that don't have a license are struggling to get rides to court and to treatment. The cost of a missed ride is a warrant going out for their arrest, and then they land themselves back up in jail, hoping to then get out again to be able to get valid. After all those penalties, then they have to wait out the driver's license revocation period, which can range anywhere from 30 days to a year. Nobody's saying change that. On a third DUI, they have to wait out at least a year, and they have to submit proof of rehabilitation to the Department of Public Safety Satisfaction. Bottom line is when somebody's ready to get going again, when they've done all this, they've paid their price, they've gotten through treatment, they've waited out the revocation period, they're ready to begin again so that they can have reliable transportation to get to work, to get to treatment, to meet their obligations. $680 is for most of my clients, is one take-home paycheck every 2 weeks. You know, if they're lucky enough to make $30,000 a year, that's about what $680 runs you on a biweekly paycheck. In my county, of the 10 judges, I know that not a single judge would be opposed to this. They're sick and tired of the caseload, just continuing cases to get people valid. I don't think that this is a kinder and gentler way to handle DUIs. I think it's a sensible way. There's still the jail time. There's still the fine. There's still the suspensions for a long time. Once the suspension ends, the individual has a lot of catching up to do in terms of, you know, getting back to employment, getting back to supporting their family. And we just want to see if there's a little tweak that can be done to make it a little bit easier for people that are trying to do the right thing.
Mr. Schwantes, could you read me that list of the other fees or assessment fees that they have to pay, and that's before they even pay for this to get their license back?
Sure.
Right?
Usually, if it's beyond a first offense DUI, there's jail time. And a number of jails throughout the metro area and throughout the state are charging per night in jail. I think Sherburn County Jail, for example, charges $30 a night if you're just sitting in jail. So there's that cost in addition to the cost of being away from home. Fines on misdemeanor DUIs range from $50 to $1,000. Typically in my county, they're about $500 for a first offense. For a gross misdemeanor, they range from $50 to $3,000. There's the surcharge and law library fee of $72. There's a probation supervision fee, and in my county, it depends on the nature of the offense, whether it's a misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor, or felony, but that ranges from $100 to $300. On a lot of these DUI offenses, I believe it starts at the second offense, there's a mandatory chemical use assessment that is ordered, and the standard charge is $125 for that. Most defendants, as a condition of their release, beyond a first offense, certainly, and oftentimes on a first offense in my county, are ordered to submit to random drug and alcohol tests at a cost of $16 per test. And those tests are usually taken at a facility in St. Paul on 7th Street, which means for my clients who have a tough enough time getting out to Stillwater, then they have to figure out a way to get out to 7th Street in St. Paul. That's about it as far as the fees. The other thing is just the getting the rides to court and then the waiting out of the suspension period. The suspension periods do make a substantial impact on people's lives, and you can only depend on friends and families for rides to court and to work for so often before those rides fall through and you end up losing your job. And then you're in this cycle of not having the money to be able to pay these fees, and certainly not to, certainly don't have the money to pay the reinstatement fee in one fell swoop.
Mr. Schwantes, for all these fees that you just listed for us, there are no waivers for people who qualify for a public defender?
Other than the fine, Madam Chair, other than the fine, the court can order a minimum mandatory fine of $50 for public defender clients, and that is in the criminal statutes. As far as the surcharges, the supervision fees, the chemical use fees, the UA fees, when we ask the court to consider waiving those fees, the judges will say that's beyond my power, that's an executive agency that has made the decision to charge that fee. As far as the supervision fee, some of our probation agents will consider hardship and may forgive or may order a sliding fee scale for the probation fee. But by and large, my clients are paying those fees, if not right away, then on a payment schedule to probation.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, who orders the sliding fee if that's enacted?
The supervision fee.
Oh, thank you, Senator. Madam Chair, as far as the probation fee, that's not ordered in court at all. That's something that when somebody's placed on probation and they go downstairs to set up probation, they meet with their probation agent, and there's a big sign right at the desk that says, if this is a misdemeanor, you owe this amount. If it's a gross misdemeanor, you owe this amount. The client has to say, I can't afford this, and then they may consider a sliding scale. But my experience and my understanding is that doesn't typically happen all that often, and it's certainly not advertised.
Madam Chair, my
Senator
question
Lamar.
is, and I don't remember if my memory is correct or not, but when some of these more expensive fees went into effect, it not only was to reclaim some of the expense, not all, but some, but it was also put in as a dollar certain amount, kind of as a penalty. And now we're making the penalty much more easy to pay off, aren't we?
Well,
there is an increase in it, but now we're creating a payment plan. You know, when someone gets arrested for DUI, aren't we, at least in the past 10 to 20 years, we've been trying to be or grab that person's attention and make them realize that what they're doing is going to be a cost for their poor judgment. And the financial fee in a lump sum, like we have now, is written that way, I think, for that purpose. And so are we stepping back away from that type of penalty and now making it easy? Is the penalty becoming an easier thing to deal with?
Madam Chair, if I might.
Senator Latz.
The criminal penalties are set as maximum in statute. It defines the level of offense. For misdemeanor, it's $1,000. For a gross misdemeanor, it's $3,000. Anything above that is a felony. All of the other fees by statute and, frankly, by Constitution cannot be considered penalties or part of a sentence for the criminal conviction. They have to be considered fees for purposes of recovering costs of providing some of the services. So otherwise you get into issues of double jeopardy. You get into issues, lots of constitutional issues relating to due process and defendants' constitutional rights. I think the policy background behind instituting these fees, while some people may have thought in their own minds, let's penalize them more, at least the public record ought to be that it was fees for purposes of helping to fund the administration of the criminal justice system and some of the consequences of driving one of the influence of alcohol in society.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Latz or Mr. Schwantes, I have a number of questions just to make sure that I understand your numbers in the right context. The $30 a night fee, is that also applying for indigent defendants?
Senator, Madam Chair, that is a that's a fee that every county has authority under legislation in the past few years to order. Not every county orders that. But in the example that I was using, Sherburne County, they do send a bill to everybody that stays in their jail for $30 a night, and then that defendant has to appeal to the jail, hey, I can't afford this. And the jail asks them, well, how much can you afford? And they work something out. So there are ways around that, I suppose. But, again, they're sending out bills to everybody that stay there.
Okay. And, Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Schwantes, most of the rest of the fees that you referenced, the supervision probation fee, the chemical use assessment, the UA fee at $16 a time, those would normally only come into play if a person had at least a second or, you know, wouldn't usually come into play with a first offense, would it, based on what you told us, or am I incorrect?
Mr. Schwantes.
Thank you, Senator, Madam Chair. The supervision fee in my county, anyway, comes into play in every single DUI. So if you're on every single DUI where you're found guilty, you're placed on probation, you're paying something to community corrections in my county. And most people, as a condition of release on DUIs, are ordered to submit to random UAs, and that is $16 in occurrence. So those are happening. Those two fees are happening for the large majority of everybody who's arrested or, in the case of the probation fee, convicted and placed on probation. In the case of anybody just arrested for first offense, they're paying the UA fees. Everybody's paying the surcharge law library fee of $72. Everybody's paying some kind of fine if they're found guilty. So I suppose the only thing that the judge has discretion on is the fine. The individual agencies, in some instances, will make allowances, but I'm not seeing that happening significantly.
Madam Chair. I might supplement the answer. I think some counties have different practices. The chemical use assessment fee is set by statute for a first-time DWI at $125, for a repeat offender at $130. Some judges or some counties, by their own internal policy or practice, do have this exercise their discretion to waive some or all of that fee. There are some counties will waive all but $25 of it, and the judge will say that they don't have discretion to waive the last $25. There are some that say if you come in with your own private insurance, they'll waive or private paid assessment, or if you expect to get one and it gets verified by probation, they'll waive all of it sometimes. So that varies by judge and by county practice. But every alcohol-related incident, whether it ends up resolved as a DWI conviction or reduced to a careless driving conviction, you have to go through a chemical use assessment with the standards set forth in statute.
Members, let me bring us back to the bill. I mean, this discussion is informative. And the reason why I wanted the information repeated is because I think it goes to the point that Senator Latz was trying to address, which was that if people are paying these fees and then they have to pay the additional $600 whatever to get their license back, they've already out of pocket a lot of money, and then to have to come up with more money in order to get your driver's license back, that's what makes this onerous. So Senator Latz's bill is not addressing these fees, although they come into play in the context that after people have to pay all of that, then the real fee of trying to get their license back becomes maybe the impossible because they've spent all their money on the other fees already. So,
Madam Chair, and the evidence of that is that the Minnesota courts have provided me with information that in 2006 there were 39,000 driving after revocation convictions in Minnesota. That's almost as many as there were DUIs in Minnesota.
40, yeah.
Did you have more questions, Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I do. I would like to follow up just with this concern. And first, I have a question, because I know that once a person has a DUI conviction, the cost of their insurance goes up dramatically. And I'm concerned that people are back on the roads driving without insurance, as often happens in these situations, because the cost of insurance is so high on top of all these other fees. But then you have other victims out there when you have repeat offenses. So my question is, when someone comes to get their driver's license back, do they have to have proof that they have insurance on whatever vehicle they own, since the two aren't really tied together? And if not, is it a good idea to make it easier for them if they can't afford these fees? Are they going to be able to afford the insurance coverage to be out driving?
Madam Chair,
Senator Latz.
Senator Olson, the rule of thumb I've been told is that one can expect their auto insurance to go up 3 to 4 times, probably $10,000 or $15,000 over the next 5 years if you get a DUI conviction or an implied consent license revocation on your driving record. So it is a very significant financial hit. My understanding is that in order to get your driving privileges or license renewed, you do have to submit insurance information to the Department of Public Safety to show that at least if you own a vehicle, you've got insurance coverage. If you don't own a vehicle, I think you have to prove that you have or show that you have non-owner operator's insurance as well.
I think we have a good understanding of the bill and your rationale for bringing it forth. Let's take testimony from I think there's some people who like to speak in opposition to the bill. So let's hear from – nobody is here to speak in opposition to the bill. All right? Yes, Senator Limmer.
I just wanted to
know – Ms. McCormick, please come up to the table.
Senator Latz, do you know if the organization MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, have they made any comment about your bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I have not received any feedback from them at all. I know that MAD and the Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs Association, those organizations do watch the bill introductions carefully, and they have a regular presence here. They weigh in when they have an opinion on something. I've not gotten any feedback at all from them one way or the other.
Thanks.
Ms. McCormick, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And while the department is not opposed to the concept that certainly there are drivers that want to get their license reinstated and the costs may seem prohibitive because of their economic circumstances, the concern we have is that this substantially cuts into the base of our budgets in the Department of Public Safety. In the preliminary fiscal note that we did, and we have not seen Senator Latz's proposal from the Amendment 3, so we certainly will take a look at that. But in our proposal, it would be a significant cut, which would result in us having to lay off between 10 and 12 staff in our division in driver services. And we don't even have 10 driver evaluators, and those driver evaluators are the staff that have to meet with people that have compliance issues. So this is a major concern to us. And I think the BCA and State Patrol, which are both part of our department, would also see a significant reduction in the amount of money that they need in order to perform what's required of us in terms of this DWI program. And so those would be the concerns that we have. There have been different discussions we've had in terms of a different way to try to allow a driver to possibly be able to do some kind of a credit card transaction so that there would at least be a way for them to finance it through a credit card. But we right now technologically wouldn't have the capability of doing that. But that certainly is something that we've looked at and thought would be, in our mind, a much better way, because otherwise we could be required to become kind of a collection agency as well. So those would be our concerns. But certainly we support the concept that not everyone, this would allow more people to get their driver's licenses reinstated.
Ms. McCormick, when did this fee go into effect, this surcharge go into effect?
I think it was in 2001 or 2002.
2002. Is that right, Mr. Turner?
Well, it's Madam Chair, members, it's in the bill. It's $40, a $40 surcharge that was increased to $145 in July of 2002 and $430 in 2003.
In 2003. Ms. McCormick, how much money was expected from... Does this surcharge come directly to Motor Vehicle Services?
Driver and Vehicle Services collects the entire fee when the driver is reinstated, but then the law allows for it to be apportioned to various funds, and we get... one portion of the fund, but we don't get the entire fund or the entire amount.
In terms of dollars, how much of the $430 are you currently getting?
I'm trying to remember what it is. I think that I want to say we get about 20% of the money, but I'd need to go back and look and verify that. I just need to have my other folder with me.
Well, this question might be asked of you in the Transportation Committee because this bill will be going there. And if you have to lay off 10 employees, if this bill took place, did you hire 10 people when this fee went into effect?
Madam Chair.
Ms. McCormick?
Madam Chair, it says here that we get 20% of that fund. Of the $250 distribution, which is what I thought it was. And, no, we used to have more driver evaluators, but we also had reductions that were required with the when there, you know, there were budget issues several years ago, so we had to lay off additional staff. And so... we certainly wouldn't lay off all of our 10 to 12 evaluators. We would have to lay off other staff, but it would mean that as a result, in terms of us being a fee-based budget, we have a fee-based budget. We have to raise the revenue, and we looked at this obviously when we prepared our budget, and in terms of our staffing and how we're performing our duties. In addition to that, we receive over 1.2 million calls a year. And so you're also talking about additional stress on our call center if we're having to make calls related to collections or if we have to contract out for those services. So those are some of the dilemmas. I think we would certainly try very hard to find a way not to lay off any staff. But if you're looking at one of the effects, there, in some way we're going to have to... we're going to have to reduce our services in some way if we have this kind of a budget reduction.
Any other questions? Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair and Ms. McCormick, let me just comment on the credit card issue that you mentioned, because the Senate's State and Local Government Operations Committee has been looking at that particular issue. And the problem is, of course, if there's a fee, a charge of $700, and somebody pays their $700 fine, the government collects $700. If they pay it by a credit card, the credit card company charges. They have a fee attached to it. We think that it's free, but it isn't. So the government does not get $700. It gets less than that because of the fee. So you actually don't get the full amount if they pay by credit card. And, you know, do you say, well, it's $700 if you pay cash, it's $720 if you pay by credit card. That seems odd, too. So that doesn't solve the problem either by paying by credit card. We don't have an answer for that yet, but that it raises other issues.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, I guess I would just say, though, if you're looking at the value of having the money now, that probably offsets getting without an interest over four years. It probably more than offsets that. I guess I'd be more concerned using a credit card that we're encouraging indigent people to put something on a credit card that will then probably cost them twice as much in the long run in terms of trying to pay it back.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Olson, that may very well be. The issue came up in regular government services. So, for instance, buying tabs or things like that, where, you know, we'd have to have two different tiers, whether you buy by credit card, by pay cash, and so forth. So it's a vexing issue that people just don't have the answer to yet. So,
any further questions for Senator Latz or the witnesses? Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The fact of the matter is a lot of indigent people don't have credit cards either. Or if they do, their limits aren't at $700. They're at $300. You know, you can renew tabs online, and you pay an extra fee for the privilege of doing that if you use a credit card or you do it by ACH through DPS. I think it's a $4.50 additional fee or something like that.
$1.25.
Okay, for the privilege of doing it online instead of in person. But the only other thing I was going to add, Madam Chair, was that I don't think there'd be any collections phone calls that would have to be made. The department would, if they don't pay up their renewal after a year, then they just get resuspended or re-revoked, and that's the end of that.
Madam Chair, I'll move that Senate File 680 as amended be recommended pass be referred to the Committee on Finance.
On Senator Betzel's motion, Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I have a couple questions.
Oh, sorry.
On page 2, line 29, there's a handling charge in here. Doesn't specify it. Oh, where's Ms. McCormick? I was going to ask you a question. When a person just renews their driver's license, I assume whatever that fee is, that's the handling fee for the renewal of the license. What is that amount?
Ms. McCormick.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, the amount varies on whatever for the driver's license. I think it's a $5 we call it a filing fee is what we call it.
When I go in and renew my driver's license, I pay more than $5.
For the filing fee.
Well, let me ask
Senator Neville,
how much do you believe the handling charge would be if we pass the bill like this? There'd be basically one installment then, and then the final payment at the end.
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, I think the way that we tried to, because it isn't clear in the language, we assumed that it was a one-time handling fee. Now, I don't know if that's any different in the amended version or not, but the way we read it, it said that there was only a one-time handling fee rather than a yearly handling fee.
Well, if this passes and goes to finance, I'd like to know how much you think that handling fee would be. And then, Madam Chair, my second question
Senator
is
Neville.
On line 2.21. Senator Latz, you've qualified this to people who are financially eligible for a public defender. I would assume a lot of people just go in and plead guilty. They don't actually get a public defender appointed. Now, the public defender here talked about filling out the affidavit. I'm not sure. I mean, I know that they have to fill the affidavits out. I'm not sure how objective the criteria is for how they get it. I think it's still pretty subjective with the judge. And so is it your understanding that people could qualify for this installment if they plead guilty, but financially they would, if they would have asked for it, they would have got a public defender, or only the people who get appointed a public defender?
Senator Neville,
yeah, I understand your question, and the bill was not written to require that they be appointed a public defender, only that they financially qualify for the public defender. I would anticipate that some people might apply for the public defender if for no other reason than for the purpose of seeing if they qualify. But most of them don't understand when they go into court that they've got another $700 reinstatement fee that they're going to be facing for the driving privileges either. But I would think they could just take a copy of their application that's approved and present that to the Department of Public Safety as proof that they qualify for the installment fee. If I might answer your other question as well, the original draft of the bill on line 3.10 did state a handling charge may be imposed for each installment payment. It doesn't say one time. And the amendment also says for each installment payment. Now, for some reason, the fiscal note came back, assumed a one-time $10 handling fee. It was anticipated, at least by me, that that would be separate and apart from the $28.50 or whatever the typical renewal fee is at the Department of Public Safety. And that would be one way to offset it. One thing the fiscal note did not consider was those individuals who would otherwise be driving revoked but decide they can actually afford to get reinstated and apply for reinstatement and pay the reinstatement fee. So instead of having 29,000 reinstatements, maybe you'll have 35,000 reinstatements every year, and there's no influx of new revenues from those folks reflected in the fiscal note at all.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Latz, if this bill does pass and move, I guess I'd suggest that on line 2.21, that we somehow rewrite it to make it clear you don't have to actually have a public defender appointed. But, you know, if you fill – but I assume you'd have to fill out an affidavit and a court would have to certify or something like that that you qualify for the installment.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Senator, on that note, I agree with you. I think that the way the language reads right now, I would read that to say that you have to be qualified for a public defender in order to have this apply. It's not that you could be or you might be. You actually have to have it. I wonder if it might be more clear or if it might help if it would say on line 21 that somebody who may be qualified financially for a public defender. That doesn't mean you actually have to have it, but at least you meet the eligibility for it.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, somebody has to determine that. So I'm just suggesting that we make the language crystal clear that, you know, if you don't have a public defender who's going to ask the court, I mean, if you get a public defender appointed, you're per se going to qualify for this because you qualified for the PD, but otherwise a judge is going to have to certify that you would have qualified.
Or, Madam Chair, Senator Neville may be eligible for a public defender?
As long as the court certifies, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry. Because otherwise public safety will be doing it. And they don't want to – that will drive the fee even higher for them.
Well, Senator Betzel and Senator Neville?
No, I think Senator Latz ought to be
– we got to fix it.
Fix it, yeah.
Madam Chair, I'll work on that. Yeah. We could also say and who applies for and qualifies financially for a public defender. That way the screening process will occur in the courthouse through people who are already trained to do that kind of screening, and the burden will clearly not then fall on the Department of Public Safety to screen.
Would you like to have that put on now?
Yes.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Latz, that would work for the ones who get a public defender. It won't work for the ones who just want to come in and plead guilty right away and never get one.
That's correct, Madam Chair, Senator Neville, and I can't think of an easy way to deal with that, except maybe to post in the courthouse that if you want to qualify for an installment payment on your license reinstatement fee, you should apply for the public defender and at least get a screening that says you financially qualify. Whether you end up with a public defender or not, you know, would be an apposite. Frankly, it might be to the benefit of a lot of people. Maybe the public defender's office wouldn't want to see an increase, but a lot of people need defense services that don't actually get it, and it might not be a bad idea as an incentive to get them in to see if they qualify.
All right.
Senator Latz, why don't you this is actually a judiciary issue, and we should actually try to resolve it here without sending it to transportation.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
That's why I think the word, you know, who may be eligible for a public defender, a person can be eligible whether you apply for it or not, whether a public defender is appointed or not, whether you qualify or not. I mean, as long as you're eligible, as long as you meet certain criteria, I think that would qualify for it. So I think that if you're eligible for a public defender, even if you plead guilty, I think that might meet the threshold test. And it certainly takes away the connotation that the language has right now, that you actually have to be qualified for it, which indicates to me that you actually did apply for it and had a determination on it. So I would think, unless somebody can suggest a better language, that on line 221, page 2, that somebody who is eligible financially for a public defender, you know, might be a better way to get at it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
I'm sorry. My only concern with that is it leaves open the question of who screens the person for eligibility. And if not at the courthouse, then you'll have people who find out later that they can get this an installment plan. They show up at the Department of Public Safety motor vehicle window and saying, I want to apply because I'm eligible for a public defender, so give me an installment plan. And that would have a whole other level of staffing implications for DPS, which I don't think would be helpful.
Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I'd just add something to what Senator Betzold is proposing and just say, and who the court certifies is eligible, meets the eligibility requirements for a public defender. So you don't have to actually have one appointed to you, as long as the court certifies in the sentencing order that I certify that you would have qualified for a public defender.
Madam Chair, perhaps.
Senator Betzel.
Who is certified as eligible for a public defender?
Well, don't you think we should say by the court?
Yeah.
Just to make it clear who's got to do it.
Who's certified by the court as eligible?
Mr. Backus, do you have anything that captures all of that? Who is eligible or is certified by the court?
Well, I think who the court certifies as being financially eligible for a public defender under Section 611.17.
I think that works.
Yep.
Mr. Backus, read it again.
And beginning with who, and who the court certifies as being financially eligible for a public defender under Section 611.17.
Senator Latz, does that work?
I believe it does, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
I just wonder if we put that language in there without directing the court to make that determination. If the court just doesn't do it, does that give them some discretion? Or would it be something where the person would just make a point of asking for that?
Madam Chair?
Senator Neville.
I think the court has discretion. I mean, theoretically, they do right now on whether they appoint a public defender, although most who ask probably get it. But that's a subjective process already.
On Senator Betzel's motion.
Yes.
Senator Betzel moves the amendment as stated by Mr. Backus. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Senator Betzel renews his motion that Senate file 680, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Senator Latz, the larger Finance Committee, then will reroute it to Transportation. Is there any further discussion among committee members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
Maybe is Ms. McCormick still here? We already heard this for discussion purposes in the Finance Division today. And there was Ms. McCormick, just if you could just listen. If this bill passes and goes to finance, can I raise this now?
Sure.
Is that okay? The fiscal note showed about $10 million, but if you just cut the reinstatement fee by $200 by half, it's only $6 million, according to the number of reinstatements you have. And I'd like you to be prepared to answer that when we get to finance. The fiscal note, the preliminary one was confusing. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Latz, I just have one more question for clarification so I understand this correctly. This is not distinguishing between repeat offenders in terms of giving everyone this opportunity, so everyone will have this opportunity regardless whether it's a third, fourth, fifth conviction?
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that's correct.
I suppose I should ask, is there anybody in the audience who's here to testify either for or against this bill? See none. On Senator Betzel's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
Nay.
The motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator O.C. Senator Osteen, welcome back to the Judiciary Committee.
Madam Chair, I'm not afraid of many things, but I'm afraid of this table.
We are your friend, right? Senator Osteen.
Excellent.
I'm still afraid of this committee.
Senator Osteen, Senate File 447.
Today I have testifying with me from the St. Cloud Police Department is Lieutenant Jim Mortensen. I'd like him to join me at the table.
Lieutenant Mortensen, please come forward.
I have an author's amendment. I'd like to move at this time.
We'll pass out the amendment. And Senator Osteen, since you've already had this bill heard in transportation, I think the rule is you've used up your one author's amendment. But we We'll pass out the amendment, we'll discuss it, and I'll see if there's a member of this committee who will move it for you.
Thank you.
Members, it's in your packets. You have it. It's underneath the bill. Senator Osteen, why don't you explain the bill and incorporating in the amendment?
Madam Chair, I'll briefly explain the bill and then pass it over to the lieutenant. This is a bill for, it's very similar to the hit and run to the stop arm violation bill. If somebody violates a school stop arm, they can prosecute them for the owner of the vehicle. And so the lieutenant in St. Cloud noticed the high number of hit and run incidences they were having, and so he thought that this might be a way to at least be able to get I'll turn it over to him. He's got a pretty good synopsis of the bill.
Lieutenant, why don't we have you testify, and then we'll go back to the mechanics of the bill. Please restate your name for the record.
My name is Lieutenant Jim Mortensen of the St. Cloud Police Department. Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. A few years ago, we were having a rash of hit-and-run crashes in our city. We average approximately 370 hit-and-run crashes a year, and out of that number, we are able to solve a very small amount of them, roughly 70 of them a year on average. It was becoming problematic for us, so I was looking for ways that we could get another tool in our toolbox to go after and try and identify the drivers that were involved in these crashes. Through review of the statutes, I was looking at the school bus stop arm violation statute, and what I came up with an idea was to take the same language that is in that statute and apply it over to this one. And the language in that statute basically says that if we go and make contact with the owner of the vehicle, if that owner of the vehicle refuses to provide the name of the driver of the vehicle that they loaned it to, then we can charge the owner of the vehicle and put the onus back on them. That was kind of the history of a way for us to try and solve this problem. There's a lot of victims out there that get their motor vehicle struck and the other driver takes off, and they're sometimes left with having to pay their deductibles. Sometimes they're injured. Sometimes there's medical bills. They also go with a loss of their motor vehicle at times to get it repaired, and sometimes loss of work. So I didn't want to forget the victims in this, and I was trying to find an effective way to go after the driver of these crashes.
Senator Betzel.
I'm trying to, I'm confused a bit by the 8-2 amendment. It refers to line 14, the word owner, and I don't see the word owner on line 14. Line 15, owner, apostrophe S, I don't see that. And then it says after line 21, which is part of the effective date. I'm just wondering if we have it, was there an engrossment of this bill as it came out of transportation? Or it doesn't seem to line up. If this bill was amended in the Transportation Committee, then maybe the 8-2 amendment is drafted to that, but it doesn't seem to fit.
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair, and I'm trying to figure out what's in your packets, but there is a first engrossment to the bill.
Okay, we've got the bill as introduced, so okay. That
there is a first engrossment.
The right version.
We ought to have the first engrossment of the bill in front of the committee members.
Very good.
We'll get copies made, Senator Betzel. In the meantime, why don't we have Senator Olsen, can you talk with us? Lieutenant, are you finished with your description?
Yes, I am.
I apologize for
sure.
The interruption. We'll get the first engrossment in front of everyone that we can compare once we get it back. But Senator Olsen, can you talk a little bit about your amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. There were some questions raised in transportation, and one of those is on the amendment A2 is 1.7 and 1.8 F, where the Department of Public Safety shall not record a violation of paragraph A on an owner or leasee driver's record. So that's the object here is to try to find, you know, if somebody did a hit and run, and one of the concerns is it may have been somebody else was driving the vehicle. And this would hopefully then take away any concern about if there was, if somebody didn't want to say who it was because of, you know, possible higher penalty by actually saying who. Let me see if I got this right. It was the concern, Madam Chair, that you brought up, and Mr. Backus came up with language that, that this should address the concern about.
We'll let Senator Osteen, we'll let Mr. Backus explain that portion of the bill.
Madam Chair, the members, that particular provision, adding the new paragraph F, that takes language similar to the language that's in the seatbelt law, the primary offense seatbelt law. And it just says that the petty misdemeanor violation against the owner can't go on the person's driving record. And one of the reasons for that is under the traffic code, if a person has, I think it's, is it two or three prior petties within 12 months, the next one becomes a misdemeanor. So there are concerns about enhancing the penalty for an offense where you don't really know who the driver was. So the idea was to keep the stakes a little bit lower. So the only penalty would be the fine as a petty misdemeanor.
The bill has been explained. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, I was reading the bill when the explanation was given. I'd like, am I understanding right that your objective here is that if you don't know who it is but you've got a license plate number, you can track who the owner is, then you can go and confront the person? And can't you do that now?
Lieutenant.
Correct, Senator. What the problem we run into is many, many times we do get a license plate number. We're actually able to find the vehicle. We are able to confirm that that was the vehicle involved due to the damage involved. But when we go and talk to the owner of the vehicle, there's many times that they're either not being upfront with us, they're being evasive, or they just don't and outright refuse to provide us with the name of the person that they loan their vehicle to. There's times where they just elect to have a case of amnesia and don't want to provide that to us. Well, the way I was looking at it is it's they're the owner of the car. They should be responsible for the ones who they're loaning it out to and should help us with those investigations. I mean, our goal is to get to the driver, you know, and if the owner does not want to assist in that investigation, then the owner should go back on the owner of the vehicle.
So, Madam
Chair. Senator Neville.
So the reason that I assume you're going to argue there's no due process issue because it's not a crime, since you can't arrest a person for a petty, the most you can do is give them a ticket?
Correct.
Have you analyzed the due process question? I mean, I'm just trying to think. Isn't this similar? I guess it isn't similar to the RoboCop issue because, that's a misdemeanor, isn't it? Is running a stop
light?
Sign?
No, it's a petty.
That's a petty misdemeanor too, Senator Neville. We will have to address this issue when that gets here.
Yeah. So, I mean, at least the appellate court ruled that if you don't know who the driver is, of course, that help me out draw the distinction here. What's the difference between this bill and the RoboCop case where the court ruled it unconstitutional?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, if I may, this is very similar language to the stop arm violation. I probably should have had a copy of that for you guys to see, but it's where if somebody does violate a stop arm and they just have the driver's license, the officer could charge the owner of that vehicle with the crime unless they were willing to say who was driving the vehicle. It seems like a lot of people do crimes with or get into accidents with borrowed vehicles. And so there is quite a precedence for this. So, and it really does track that language.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, that may be, but that's what Senator Neville just indicated, that's unconstitutional. The Minnesota Supreme Court has held that you can't do what you're trying to do and not witness the thing. My suggestion would be as a first choice is to look at putting cameras on your buses. If you got deals, we put them in squads all the time, and so that one way of solving it. Otherwise, I think you're in trouble.
Senator Foley, I think that case may be distinguishable.
Well, the road RoboCop thing that's currently before the Supreme Court is different. I'm not saying that. But the Minnesota Supreme Court has already ruled on the other issue that would pertain to you stopping or arresting someone for the stop arm violation.
Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Senator Olson.
Senator Neville and Senator Foley, maybe you can help me out with this, because what I'm thinking of is, you know, what about the situation where this is a guilty party and you're going out and maybe they were involved in a hit and run and there was a death, and they don't want to provide incriminating information, and we have laws that allow them not to have to provide incriminating information. And so is it because this is a penal, a misdemeanor or a petty misdemeanor that we get away from those kinds of constitutional concerns? I don't know. So I just wanted to ask what your thoughts on that would be. And then the other thing that I wanted to point out was that you talked about, is it Sergeant?
Lieutenant.
Lieutenant, I'm sorry, Lieutenant. Lieutenant, you talked about the concern that for people who aren't being cooperative, but your bill doesn't limit this penalty to people who fail to give you the information you're looking for. It says that the person actually has to have been convicted of a crime. So even if they give you a name, but it turns out for whatever reason that person wasn't convicted, then you're still going to punish them. So, again, I just wonder if it's necessary to get to go that far, because that may not be within their control.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
And Senator Olson, if somebody does come up with a name for somebody, then there are no charges filed. Because that's the intent, is to get somebody to.
Senator Olson, I believe Senator Olson is referring to on page one, not of the engrossment, but of the one that we have in front of us.
On the amendment.
Under subdivision B1, it says the owner or the lessee or another person is convicted for that violation.
Right, Madam Chair, and I guess that was my point, that it requires them to be convicted. So they might have given the information to the police officer, but if the person was acquitted or the charges were dropped or for whatever reason something like that happened, you know, the person's cooperated, but they could still be prosecuted under this statute.
Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, that language has been changed in the A2 amendment. If you look at lines 1.2 to 1.3 of the amendment, it now is charged with violating. So it's a slightly lower standard. So as long if the other person was charged, it no longer requires that other person be convicted. So that partially addresses some of your concerns there, I think.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
Maybe Senate Counsel or somebody else, Senator Betzel or Foley, can help me on this too. Is a petty misdemeanor, would that be sufficient to trigger double jeopardy?
Double jeopardy, yeah.
So if the person really was the guilty party on the hit and run, and you give him a petty misdemeanor ticket and he pleads guilty real quick, does that prohibit the later charge? It may not, because it's not a crime. But I'm not sure. I don't know what the answer to that is.
Could that happen?
Yeah. Oh, Madam sure. Chair, Senator Neville, I think we definitely want to know the answer to that, because that could
That'd be a gift to the person who you gave a ticket to if they pled guilty and then they couldn't be charged later with a criminal vehicular negligence or a hit and run.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
One of the concerns I would have for any of this would be that the timeliness of how that is, that if the officer goes to make an investigation and a stop and an arrest, and it was happened in an event that happened a week ago or 2 weeks ago, who would remember that you are using my car on that particular day? That's the horror story, if you will.
Lieutenant?
Senator, when we have these hit-and-run crashes, they're followed up on immediately unless we can't find the owner. You know, then it might take a few days. But, you know, once the crash occurs within that shift, we're trying to follow up on it and find the owner of the vehicle. And it is possible that it could take a day or two to find the owner. But I would assume the owner would discover that their vehicle was damaged, and that would probably ring a bell with them that who they own, who they loan their vehicle to.
Senator Neville, if this would potentially triple double jeopardy, then with a school bus arm violation or emergency vehicle violation also trigger potentially double jeopardy? Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, I don't have an exact answer to that question, but I just want to point out that it would be criminal vehicle homicide and injury if for an injury case or for a death case, which is another statute.
Oh, that's so, not it. Yeah, okay.
No.
Sections 1 to 7 deal just with hit and runs.
Right. I could read you the head notes because it's driver to stop for accident with individual, driver to stop for accident to property, driver to give information, collision with unattended vehicle, notify owner of damaged property, notice of personal injury, accident report to commissioner. So that's but under the criminal vehicular homicide and injury law, there's a specific clause for drivers who cause an accident and leave the scene of the accident in violation of some of these other provisions. So that might complicate the double jeopardy question.
Madam Chair, Senate Counsel, would you like to venture an opinion on whether that would trigger double jeopardy? Do you have an opinion on that?
Madam Chair, I really couldn't venture an opinion on that.
I'm not sure either.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olcee.
If you're – obviously you guys are not comfortable until you find the answer to that. So what would be the best procedure for me to lay this on the table or
– Senator Olcee, we I think that it has implications. I mean, I think there's an answer because the language here is very much as has been stated by the lieutenant, parallels the school arm bus and the emergency vehicle, and when the camera cop bill comes up, I think the same issue will come up. So why don't we lay it on the table? We're going to get an answer to it, and then we'll definitely bring you back and have a discussion on this.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One of these days, Senator Olcee, you're going to bring me a bill, and we're going to get you out of here.
I enjoy it, actually.
This one may still get out of here. Thank you for your indulgence. And, Lieutenant, thank you for making the trip. And the next time we bring this back up, you don't have to come back.
Oh, I don't mind. I like to try and follow it through.
Thank you.
I'm having that same sort of year in the Messins Committee.
We have the gavel. Okay.
Good questions.
Take a seat. Yep. Madam Chair and members, we're going to take Senate File 1005 first.
Senator Moore?
Madam Chair and members, essentially Senate File 1005 is to respond to an issue that came up with respect to a constituent. It is a situation where a victim of a theft had to pay an impound lot fee to recover their stolen vehicle. Apparently, in the state of Minnesota, there are statutory requirements that ask that when police officers recover a vehicle, that they give due notice to the owners, but that they also have an obligation to then keep the vehicle secure, and that often results in having that vehicle being impounded. And then when the owners go to pick up their vehicle that have been stolen but have been impounded for its safekeeping, they have to pay the impound lot fee in order to get it out. And it just doesn't feel right because they were victimized by having their vehicle stolen, and then they're the ones who have to pay the fee.
So what Senate File 1005 does, and it's gone through a couple of renditions because a number of different stakeholders have been working on this bill. What Senate File 1005 is attempting to do here, and I think what I may need to do is I may need to put an author's amendment on it first.
Okay. And in addition to the author's amendment, Senator Moy, is there another amendment?
Is it just the A1?
Is there an A1?
I think that is the author's amendment.
That is the author's amendment?
Yes.
Okay.
So I move the A1 amendment as an author's amendment, yes. Madam Chair.
Senator Moise, move the A1 amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment passes.
So, Madam Chair, what the bill is attempting to do is to create a grant that will be given to the Commissioner of Public Safety, and then what the amendment is doing, what the bill is doing, is that the grant is being given to the Emergency Assistance Account at the Department of Public Safety, and the reimbursement for towing and storage fees incurred due to the impoundment of recovered stolen vehicle is now added to the categories of eligible reimbursements that people can apply to this emergency account for reimbursement. In addition to that, what the amendment does is the amendment also adds to that in instances where a victim or a family vehicle, which has become part of an investigation, gets thrown into the impound lot, it allows the individuals and the families, and when that vehicle is unknowingly have been used and is involved in an activity where it was kept in the impound lot for a long, long time for investigative purposes, if the individual who was not a party to the activities that took place with that vehicle needs to go and get it out, and oftentimes this vehicle has been in storage for a long, long time, that those individuals who are innocent of the activities that led to their vehicle being impounded and put in storage for evidence purposes may also apply for some of this money to help help them in the cases where the storage and the impound fees gets to be too high. And that's the bill. I have two individuals here who would like to speak on the bill, and so we'll start with Ms. Notice.
Ms. Notice?
Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Jennifer Notice. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota General Crime Victim Coalition. The General Crime Coalition, we are a statewide organization that services direct service organizations within the state of Minnesota. We have a membership over 70 programs. I've come to you tonight to speak in favor of this bill, and I urge you to pass it as it is written with the amendments that you have just passed. The area of motor vehicle theft is an area that is covered under the programs in which I work with, and they have drafted many concerns in relation to their work with motor vehicle theft victims. And just to paint a scenario for you and give you an idea of how this really can impact a victim, I'd like to tell you a story about a 67-year-old woman who lived in rural Minnesota with her daughter and two grandchildren. In the morning, she drives her daughter to work and her 8-year-old grandchild to school. On this particular day, after dropping off her daughter and her grandchild, she proceeds with the youngest grandchild to the local grocery store. There, she picks up a few things and then proceeds to her car. But when she gets to the parking lot, she determines that her car has been stolen. She is overwhelmed, confused. The younger child has no idea what's going on, is confused and irate in her own right. The grandmother contacts police. She makes a report. She calls her daughter at work, who is upset but is able to find a ride home. She calls the school of the 8-year-old, where she's able to convince an old friend to drop the girl off on her way home from work. The groceries are continue to lay there in the parking lot. They continue to melt. She makes a report with the police officer, and the police officer agrees to bring her home. As soon as she gets home, she calls her insurance company. Due to her limited income, she finds out that she has limited liability on her vehicle and that the insurance company will not assist her with any costs related to the motor vehicle theft. She again is completely and utterly overwhelmed. This is a town where there is no light rail, there are no taxis, there are no buses. Public transportation doesn't exist. The closest car rental service is over an hour away. Again, the grandmother's daughter stays home from work for several days because she doesn't have a ride. The granddaughter must stay home from school because she, too, does not have a ride. Within a few days, the grandmother receives a phone call. Her car's been found in Minneapolis, hours away. She's able to secure a ride from a friend to Minneapolis, but it's 3 days later. When she arrives, she finds out she will need to pay $138 for the towing fee, plus $18 a day for the 3 days it took her to find transportation to Minneapolis. Completely frustrated, angry, overwhelmed, but with little options, she pays the fee with a credit card because she doesn't have disposable income. By the time she pays off the credit card, that $192 fee to retrieve her car has become over $500. Now, is this scenario realistic? Absolutely. Victims of motor vehicle theft, having already dealt with the initial shock and consequences of the loss of their vehicle and being a victim of crime, are shocked to find that the news of a recovered vehicle comes with a price tag. The good news is we found your car, ma'am. The bad news is you're going to have to pay to get it out of the impound lot. The Office of Justice Program, who is in charge of monitoring the emergency fund where these funds would come from, maintains a crime victim justice unit who receives complaints from victims. And what they find is that a considerable portion of the complaints that they receive are related to this issue. I will relay just a few of the stories that they've encountered. One victim whose car was severely damaged by the thieves who stole his vehicle decided to just leave his car in the impound lot because the value of the car was less than the accrued impound fees. He was told from the city that he would still be responsible for these impound fees and that if they couldn't collect directly from him, that they would hold him from his tax refund. Another victim told the justice unit that she couldn't afford to pay the impound fee and the loan on the car that was impounded. Ultimately, the city returned the car to the car dealership. Still another victim, whose car was stolen by her friend's son and used in the commission of a crime, was required to pay the entire fee for the time the car was impounded, including the time the car was being examined for evidence. Motor vehicle theft is not simply an inconvenience. The victim suffers from increased transportation costs, increased travel time. They suffer from a loss of wages related to the need to miss work, and they suffer from the increased credit card debt often associated with them trying to retrieve their vehicle from the impound fee. Not only does the victim suffer, but secondary victims as well. Those who rely on the individual for a ride to work or school suffer loss, work loss, and financial loss. Those who rely on the victim for daycare services must find alternative coverage when the victim is traveling to retrieve their vehicle. Those who rely on the victim for access to health care and doctor's appointment are left without. I do not doubt that the legislator takes this issue seriously. There have been laws in the past that have addressed motor vehicle concerns. One of the ones that the senator currently already discussed is that in which the law enforcement must contact the victim within 48 hours after locating their vehicle. Another law in effect protects the victim in the event that a traffic citation is issued by those who stole their vehicle and allows that if they present some information of verification that they have been prosecuted for motor vehicle theft, then they'll be automatically dismissed. In addition, the legislator passed the auto theft prevention grants. However, despite all of these changes, what we find is that 95% of those victims of motor vehicle theft report that they receive no financial assistance or assistance otherwise in relation to the crime. The financial impact of this crime is just too great. I urge you to consider passing the proposed legislative changes so that victims can be appropriately reimbursed in a timely fashion in a situation they did not create, did not ask for, and would rather forget. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Notice. Is it Biermeier?
It is indeed, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. Senator Mua. My name is Mary Biermeier, and I'm the Director of the Victim Witness Services Division in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office. I've held that position for just shy of 20 years, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you in favor of establishing a motor vehicle theft account for victims. During my tenure, I've talked to literally hundreds of victims of auto theft, and as I'm sure you know, many people out there do not have any extra money set aside to pay for getting their car out of the impound lot. Even if they could find some way to borrow the money, the cost of getting the car goes up and up each day until it is often out of reach. Often, if the car is not recovered by the victim within 60 days, it is either auctioned off or, in some cases, destroyed.
Several years ago, this legislation was passed that required law enforcement to notify the victim within 48 hours. That was a huge improvement, and it's good when it works, but when that notification is not easily made, sometimes there is still the initial fee for towing and storage that is unaffordable for many people. Also, some vehicles are so damaged during the crime spree that they need to be towed from the impound lot to a service station or back to the victim's home, depending on what they can afford, another cost that is often very difficult to incur. Truthfully, it would be ideal if we could waive these fees for victims of auto theft altogether. But I understand the economics of the problem and that towing companies and impound lot owners need to make a living too. This bill, in my opinion, makes the best of a bad situation in that it allows the fees to be assessed and paid, but the victim doesn't have to pay them. As a victim service provider, I can't emphasize enough how needed and how valuable and how fair this legislation is for victims of crime. As I said earlier, I have talked to countless people that have had one car that gets them to work and the kids to daycare, and without it, they are in danger of losing their job. Recently, I spoke with a young man about 19 or 20 years old who was going to a technical college here in St. Paul, and he had his car stolen. He lived with his mom, who was ill with cancer and needed the car to get to her treatments. Every extra penny in that household was going to pay his tuition. They did not have any money to pay for the impound lot fees. Also in that instance, the car was so severely damaged that it would need multiple additional repairs. When a suspect is arrested and hopefully charged and successfully prosecuted, there is some hope of the offender paying restitution for damages at a future time. But in many scenarios, it is not possible to identify a suspect or arrest them, and so there is no restitution to be hoped for. Minnesota Statute 611A.675 allows programs such as mine to apply for small emergency grant monies that's been referenced to, up to a maximum of $5,000 annually to provide assistance to victims in emergency situations that are a direct result of them being a victim of crime. To date, we have been using that money for all kinds of emergency situations that crime victims find themselves in: stolen rent and grocery money, slashed tires, broken windows, smashed door frames and locks, and relocation, sometimes mostly for victims of domestic assault. And we've been using a very large portion of it for auto theft victims, leaving less and less for other victims. Establishing a separate motor vehicle theft account will allow more people to apply and get money that they need and deserve to get their stolen car back and also their peace of mind. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, I just want to point out to you that there is a limitation. When the individual on page 4, line 26, we do provide that an individual victim can only get compensated for actual cost incurred, and that cost should not exceed $500. So,
Senator Limmer?
And my amendment changes that to $300.
Yeah, the question I had is, why did you reduce the fee, that cost, down to $300 rather than $5?
Senator Moi?
I believe that I'm not supposed to mention this, but I'm trying to be parallel with something else that's happening in another body. Senator Betzel.
I would move on page 4, line 27, in that state.
Oh, don't. Senator Betzel.
Where's your pride?
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I mean, the $300 is 2 days in the impound lot, pretty much.
Nothing.
Madam Chair and members, if it is the will
Senator
of this committee to up that number, I would not object.
So moved.
Senator Betzold has moved that we increase the $300 fee to $500.
Madam Chair.
Senator
Before
Neville?
Before we vote on that, what is a charge per day in an impound lot nowadays? I don't even know.
It's Karen. She just
I can speak to that a little bit. I'd also like to comment that here in the metro area, they only take cash. So the credit card thing might work in some other parts of the state, but having cash is very difficult for some people, obviously. Yeah. And in answer to your question, I think that the initial towing and first day or two storage seems to come in at about $130. And then the price can go up as much as $30 a day.
$30 a day?
Mm-hmm.
Senator Limmer?
But, Madam Chair, isn't there the cost of the towing fee as well? And that in a urban area like Minneapolis could be
$40.
In excess of $100, certainly.
Yeah, that's what she said.
At least it was the last time I got it.
Madam Chair and members, about 4 years ago, I got towed in Minneapolis, and we got to my car within 30 minutes, and it was $200 cash. And we were pretty dressed up in evening clothes, and we had to walk into the nearest bar to use their cash machine. We looked pretty weird.
So, Senator Moore, what would you like to do with this suggestion?
I'm perfectly okay with going up to $500, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Senator Moore moves that on line 8 of the A1 amendment just be deleted. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville?
Madam Chair, if most of these, first of all, two issues. You've been talking about the damage to the car, but this bill only relates to towing and storage. So that a part of what you're testifying to, this bill doesn't address. But the second question is, presumably these cars have car insurance, and we have mandatory uninsured coverage on every policy. And isn't a hit-and-run driver considered an uninsured vehicle? Aren't these people able to file a claim with their own insurance company to get reimbursed for, you know, the costs that they have with respect to a hit-and-run type of driver? Does anybody know the answer to that?
Senator Neville, I'm not 100% certain, but I'm thinking off the top of my head that it might make a difference whether they have collision coverage on their vehicle or not.
Don't we all have uninsured?
No fault. They're automatically covered with no fault. No fault.
Well, but under the uninsured motorist coverage, that would cover any liability that this uninsured driver might have to you. At least that's what I thought.
Senator Neville?
I need to have that clarified.
Madam Chair, actually, under your uninsured coverage, it's going to cover your liability, I think. Your liability... Well, the uninsured gives you a right to collect if you're hurt yourself, but for collision, property damage coverage, generally there's a distinction there. And I'd have to recall, but I know I've gotten in this situation with clients before, and there is a difference there.
Madam Chair, the insurance policy only comes into play with respect to the condition of the vehicle. What this bill addresses is only the towing of the vehicle in whatever condition it's in and its time in the impound lot. We can't do much about the condition of the vehicle.
Okay. Senator Neville?
It's another legal question that this bill has to go to finance, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe we can clarify that between now and then. And
oh, y'all didn't hear that today?
I mean, if no-fault uninsured coverage on a no-fault policy covers towing and storage, then we could knock it back down to $300 or something and have it apply to more people. Or maybe there's some other...
Madam Chair and Senator, could I address that, please?
Ms. Biermeier?
Yes, thank you. I'm not exactly sure if I understand the issue, but if you're talking about hit and run versus accidents versus what I'm thinking of the scenarios that I'm working with mostly with victims, these cars are just stolen from somewhere. There's no there's not like a crash or anything,
accident. And
so the only insurance would be their own. And what it seems that most people have this really I don't understand insurance very well, but they have this very, very basic coverage that doesn't cover this scenario?
Madam Chair, or Senator Moy, I think basically you'd have to have collision in order to, or in actually in this case it would be an intentional act, and I don't think you'd find insurance coverage that would cover that.
Madam Chair, what if there's no damage to the car? It just got stolen and abandoned somewhere, and now you got towing and storage.
Right, and that would be an intentional act, Senator Neville, and I don't think that would be covered. Madam Chair. Or Senator Moy.
When this bill was being put together, my counterpart in the other body had a research memo done. And this issue was looked at, and the response was that some insurance companies cover impound fees under comprehensive insurance coverage. But insurance companies are not obligated to provide this coverage under statute, right. Minnesota Statute Chapter 65B. And so I think that people may try to get reimbursement for mm-hmm. it, but I think that because I think it's not set in policy, it might be a hit and miss kind of a situation.
Right. Senator Moy, I think what Ms. Biermeier was talking about is when people say they have minimal insurance, they usually mean they have liability only, and then that this wouldn't cover. But in a situation, even when you have comprehensive collision, you still have to, you can buy additional insurance that will cover towing and storage, but it's not required by statute. I think that's what they're saying. But Senator Moy, I have another question about whether there's anything in the bill to address this. It seems to me that when people make claims under the Victims Reparations Fund, that there's an automatic requirement that you have to order that fund to be reimbursed through a restitution order. And I'm wondering if there should be a similar provision in this bill that would require the perpetrator to have to repay this fund to the extent we could try to get that money from them to try to put some funds into keeping this thing going.
Madam Chair, to answer your question, the A1 amendment deleted pages 1 to 3, sections 1 to 3, with respect to the reparation. So what this does is it creates a crime victim's account, and then it puts it into the emergency assistance pot that doesn't go through the victim reparation process.
But, Senator Moy, would it be possible to still order restitution to that fund? Senator Foley?
I have another area that I wanted to talk to you about.
Okay.
And I'd suggest to the author that you seriously ought to consider put some kind of a limitation in there so that I know on abandoned vehicles that you can do that, and the tow companies usually will get some limited liability, if you will, on that. And that way that if the car is stolen and sits in the lot there for 10 days, that you only set it at 2 days or 3 days.
I've actually been and make the towing lot
responsible for anything after that.
So Senator Moy?
Senator Foley, are you suggesting that
one of the problems is, when you're looking at that and you get a car that's missing for a long period of time and the thing goes up $30 a day, why it doesn't take long to put somebody out of the market on that.
Senator Foley, I don't, I don't quite know how we can do that. Although I do know that if we did go in that direction, where we make the impound lot sort of hold the bag for some of it, I think this bill would probably get lots of people here testify in opposition to it. And I certainly would like to entertain that thought. And so I'll put it out there for people to hear to see if anybody will come and see me. But between maybe this hearing and the next one, the next stop in finance, I would like to see if anybody would like to come and talk to me about that. But I don't think I would like to put that on this bill.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair and Senator Moore, I don't think there's an impound lot in the entire state that's got enough room to hold cars indefinitely. You just can't do it. There's only so much space, and I'm not quite sure beyond that what you were, and especially if it's going to take up space and not be reimbursed at some point. That,
well, there's,
you'll have everybody and his uncle in to visit you at that point.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, I think that's true. There are a lot of implications. Another thing that I didn't tell you before, but if you have your personal effects in that car, and go down there, and the towing agency won't let you get at them until you pay the whole fee.
No, that's not true.
You can have some real.
We changed the law a couple of years ago on that.
In Minneapolis, you have an ordinance that's different, but I don't think that it covers.
Madam Chair, there are no more helpful discussion on this, and if there are no more amendments, okay. I'd like to move the bill.
Okay. Senator Moi has moved
Senate File 1005 as amended.
Okay. Senate File 1005 as amended.
Be recommended to
referred to recommended to pass and re-referred to finance. All those in
Wait.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold and I were sitting here wondering why every section had its very own effective date when they were all the same effective date. Whether we shouldn't fix this up just a tad.
Senator Moi.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members, a few years ago we started going to having effective dates after every section, and it's an easier way to draft, and it makes it a lot easier for us. As far as it being the same date, you know, you could put one effective date at the end of the bill. Since that's the default date anyway, you could delete it. It really doesn't matter.
Senator Higgins or Senator Moi?
Madam Chair, I renew my motion.
Senator Moi renews her motion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Madam Chair, I'd like to take up Senate File 493.
Senator Moi?
Madam Chair, members, thank you. And I know the hour is running late, but I ask for your indulgence. This is a very important bill. Let's see. Where am I testifying?
Okay.
It's over
here.
Madam Chair, members, too many of our children are being recruited to join criminal gangs and are getting killed because of gang activities. Our residents are subjected to the loud noise, profanity, fights and sounds of gunfire echoing in the streets of our neighborhoods. And our parks and community centers are riddled with gang graffiti and gang drug trafficking, and our sidewalks and streets are taken over by gangs. In some parts of our neighborhoods, our residents are not safe even when they're in their own homes because of the stray bullets from gang activities taking place outside their doorsteps. In some parts of our cities across the state, criminal gangs and criminal gang violence are ever increasing, and the tools that we currently have do not enable us to make enough of a dent. This bill, the Civil Gang Injunction Law, will be a valuable tool in curbing illegal gang activity in our neighborhoods. This tool will allow us to turn the public places that has been taken over by criminal gangs will turn over our public places to our law-abiding citizens. Instead of prosecuting one gang member at a time in a criminal proceeding, this tool will enable us to target multiple individuals in one civil action. So we can virtually shut down the criminal gang and its business by taking out its most active gang members, and at the same time send a loud message to the gangs that we will not tolerate their behaviors, and send a message to the community that they can be safe in their own homes and neighborhoods. It has been an effective and innovative tool in the states of Texas and California to help them combat street gang activity and to reduce the strangleholds that the gangs have taken on their communities. What this bill does, Madam Chair and members, will help us to get selected gang members and prohibit them from engaging in specific activities. I would like to first walk through the bill with you, and then I will have testifiers speak on behalf of the bill. If you look at, let's see. Oh, I have.
Senator Moi, do you have an amendment?
I do have the A2, the author's amendment.
Senator Moi moves the author's A2 amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the A2 amendment, if you look at Section 1 is a definition that we will refer back to. The gist of the tool is in Section 2, which defines a criminal gang that continuously or regularly engages in gang activities is a public nuisance. Continuously or regularly is defined above as a at least five separate incidents or occurrences in a period of not more than 12 months. The bill also defines or identifies that the continuous or regular use of a place by a criminal gang for engaging in gang activity that is knowingly permitted by the person who owns or is responsible for maintaining the place is a public nuisance. And I'd like to members to draw your attention to the fact that this section of the bill doesn't make it automatic. In later part of the bill, we provide a specific provision for notice to the property owners. And the notice provision specifies that the notice will be in writing and served personally or by certified mail, return receipt requested to the property owner. That's on page 2, line 2.1 through 2.3. Line 2.4 says that notice will state that a nuisance, as defined in section 617.92, is occurring in the place. Number 2, the notice will summarize the evidence indicating that a nuisance is occurring. And then the notice will also inform the recipient that a failure to abate the conduct constituting the nuisance or to otherwise resolve the matter within 60 days of the service of the notice may result in a filing of a complaint. So that's an issue that we worked out with the multi-housing association to help address the concerns of property owners. And then, Madam Chair, Member, Section 3 basically says a county or city attorney, the attorney general or a resident of the state may sue to enjoin a public nuisance under this section. And then Section B says a person may be sued, and a person who is responsible for maintaining a place that is continuously or regularly used may also be sued. That's basically the gist of the bill, Madam Chair and members. And I have here Council Member Gary Schiff from Minneapolis, who would like to testify on behalf of the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Schiff.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Mula, for sponsoring this important piece of legislation that really gives hope to those of us who've been fighting gangs for so long in the city of Minneapolis. My district, Ward 9 in the city of Minneapolis, my constituents are one-third of them are children. And my district currently has 11 active gangs recruiting those children, gangs with names like the Serenos, the Vatos Locos, the Latin Kings, the Somali Hot Boys, the Bloods, the Crips, the Kings, the Rolling Twenties. It goes on and on. Almost every corner in my district is a corner where children are at risk as they walk to school. Bill Ziegler, the executive director of Little Earth of United Tribes, runs a housing cooperative in my district, the largest American Indian-owned housing cooperative in the United States. And he every day works with youth who have to make that decision to get on the school bus or talk to a gang member who offers them a little bit of money and a different opportunity. The last homicide in my district was just across the street from Little Earth, where a gang member, a member of the native mob, beat somebody senseless, and he was eventually pulled off life support. That homicide was on the front page of the Star Tribune yesterday. That gang member lived and rented an apartment across the street from a housing cooperative where he knew he would have population of Native American youth to recruit into his gang. And that's how gangs operate. They operate on territory, and they go after their target market. This photograph that's been handed out to you shows a church across the street from Roosevelt High School, where gang members want to mark the wall so that as those youth come out of school, they get this message every day that there's gangs waiting to recruit them and who want them as members. This is an important tool that we can use to keep gang leadership out of territory where they're engaging in their recruitment. And I, again, thank the Senate for hearing this bill and ask for your support. It's an important new tool that law enforcement needs so that we can stop that recruitment from happening and make sure that all children have a safe place they can call home where they don't need to be making these kinds of choices.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, Section 4 of the bill talks about the temporary or permanent order for relief, and you can look through that to identify how that gets spelled out. And then Section 6 of the bill also talks about attorney's fees, and I think that was in contemplation that, you know, since we're going to have landlords or other individuals involved, we wanted to make sure that we put that in there so people feel like we're not doing this frivolously or arbitrarily. And Section 7 just talks about the evidence that's being provided that if we do serve a notice to the landlord that the evidence that we provide in the notice is prima facie evidence, but that the landlords then can also come back and provide credible evidence to help mitigate against that. So,
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, on the top of page 2, the notice provision, I'm wondering whether we need to add just a couple of things in there. And Councilmember Schiff can help me with the language probably, but in the city of Minneapolis, we usually say it must be in writing to the last known address of the owner, because there have been instances where the owners have said you didn't send me notice correctly because he had not updated his information with the regulatory agency or with the county or anybody. And so he had moved, but he hadn't told anybody. So the city, you know, sent the notice to the last known address that they had for that person. So I'm wondering if that isn't something you might want to consider. I also think that you should have a provision where the property is posted with that notice as well.
Senator Moore?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, I like both of your suggestions. On your first suggestion, my only concern is that I wanted to narrowly tailor the notice to specifically have them to be served personally or by certified mail so that we have the return receipt that they actually got the notice. I don't want to be in a situation where someone is saying, well, you sent to my last known address and I never got notice of it. I think that so I understand what you're trying to say, but I think what I'm trying to do here is to just make sure that we get it for sure. The posting on the property, I think is a good suggestion, but again, I don't know if that helps me to tighten what I wanted to do, because I don't want there to be any question whatsoever that the person who was operating or managing or owns this building didn't get notice.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Senator Moore, the posting of the property gives you the suspenders along with the belt. You know, if you send the notice to the owner and you post the property, it's not an or, it's an and. So that if, in fact, the owner has moved and is not at the address, then when the owner goes to the property, you can actually see that that there's a notice and that, you know, there should be contact information, all that kind of junk. I think it almost just has to be. And Councilmember Schiff maybe has some thoughts on that too.
Councilmember?
I know there's other circumstances where we do that, where we're giving a notice of revocation of a license, perhaps failure to pay utility bills, water bills, shutoff notices. That's the course that we follow.
Senator Moore?
And Madam Chair, I know John Choi, the St. Paul City Attorney, is coming to the door, to the table, so he can help.
He's not quite.
Well, not quite to the table.
That way.
Come sit down.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I would be open to an amendment to that effect. I was just trying to pencil out something.
Well, do you want to work on that, Senator Moore, while we take Senator Lemmer's question?
Yes.
Well, Madam Chair, on this point, what's the survivability rate of a posted sign on a corner of a building where known gang members are?
And Senator Moore, while you're answering that, Ms. Pontius is working on the language for the amendment. Senator Moore?
Well, I think Senator Lemmer knows the answer. I mean, I don't think it...
I've heard that these people are kind of antisocial. And
don't like
get graffiti on the
official notices telling them to clear the corner. But
Madam Chair and Senator Lumber, our City Attorney John Choi would like to answer that question.
Madam Chair and Senator Lumber, for the record, John Choi, St. Paul City Attorney. I think the answer to your question is that the notice requirement under Subdivision 2 only applies to Subdivision 1, Paragraph C, which is the instance where we're dealing with a property owner. So I think your question goes to when we're targeting a gang member as a defendant, that would be under Section 2 of the bill, would be Subdivision 1.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lumber.
If the goal of the suggestions of Senator Higgins to find two opportunities to inform the owner, are we really using a perfect instrument to get to the owner by posting his property when there's these people around the building all the time? I would think that it would be very easy excuse for an owner who's trying to claim that he doesn't know. Simply say, oh, you posted my building? Well, gee, I've driven by, and I don't really like to go down there because these unsavory characters are here. And when I did look from a block away, I didn't see a posted sign on my building.
Senator,
so how would I know? You know, so that's why I'm raising this question.
Senator Moi, just...
I mean, do everything you can, but I think realistically, I think it's an easy one for an owner to walk away from and say, I looked and there was no posting. There's bad guys there.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I know in Minneapolis anyway, when the inspector placards a house for, shut off of water or right. condemnation or whatever, they take a picture of it okay. so that it's there. Right. So they know that they have, so that the legal... record shows that the place has been placarded.
And Senator Moi, I guess I would only add to that if we absolutely want to make certain that there's no excuse, we could do personal service, but the problem with that is that would be quite a bit more expensive.
Madam Chair, that is the effect of the language. On page 2, line 2.2, it says that the notice must be in writing and served personally or by certified mail with return receipt requested. And okay. so that was my way of making sure that we actually, get it. But I'm also concerned. I mean, what if we can't track down the landlord to get them to sign the return receipt? Then I guess, the ideas of the posting or other forms of notification would be sufficient.
Senator Moi, then would you like to have Ms. Pontius read to the members the proposed amendment?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members, I just wanted to clarify, because my understanding from what Senator Higgins said was that she wanted the posting in all cases, or do you want that as an alternative if the other forms of notice don't work?
All cases, Sorry. Madam
all
Chair.
Cases. Madam Chair, members, then I think on line page, or on the reading off the A2 amendment on page 2, line 2 after the period insert, in addition, comma, the notice must be posted at the entrance to a structure on the place. It sounds grammatically weird. The term place is a defined term in the bill, so it sounds funny. Because it can include structures and land around, so I assume you want it posted on the structure, not on a fence or something.
Ms. Pontius, could you repeat that one more time?
Madam Chair, members, on page 2, line 2, after the period, insert, in addition, comma, the notice must be posted at the entrance to a structure on the place.
On that...
Just discussion, Madam Chair. I'm not sure that posting really is going to be adding much to it, so I don't know. I think that the personal service and certified mail probably should serve the purpose for right now, so I don't know if that is adding anything. So.
Senator Neville?
Madam Chair, to add to that, this process can be begun by any resident. Yeah. It could be a private party. I'm not sure we want private parties doing the posting.
Senator Moi, what's
you have
your
to
wish?
Have a court order.
Well, Madam Chair, just so the members will know, I have struggled with whether or not I wanted to do an amendment to take away the language with respect to private individuals. Because as it was brought to my attention, do I really want two neighbors bickering with each other? And so...
Rival gangs, no less.
Madam Chair, I guess at this time, I'd like to, hearing the feedback from the committee members, I'd like to move to strike the language on line 1.28, or starting at 1.27, you know, or a resident of the state. So it would just be a county or city attorney
or
the attorney general.
Okay, Senator Moi moves to on line 2-7 of the A2 amendment to delete the comma, insert or, and then after general to delete or a resident of the state.
And the comma.
And the comma. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, Senator Moi, I had a question. As I read this under gang activity definition, does that mean that the criminal gang has to be convicted of one of the offenses in 609.11 subdivision 9 in order to initiate this activity by county or city attorney or the attorney general?
Senator Moi?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, that's a yes, and I want my city attorney to answer that because I did raise this question.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, actually it says commission, so it would not be a conviction, and it would be by the civil standard, which would be a preponderance of the evidence standard. And that's the reason why you would have a civil gang injunction. This came out of our community prosecution unit when we did some of our attorneys went to a conference and did some brainstorming with attorneys in San Diego and in Texas. And so it would be, the definition would say commission, so it's not a conviction.
Thank you, City Attorney Choi. Senator Limmer?
Now, when I read this, gang activity means a commission of, and then I look at the offenses that are listed on Subdivision 9, they're from murder all the way down to first-degree witness tampering and other offenses that are in here. Does the action of an individual trigger this action, this subsequent action? Or does there have to be an actual gang there, more than one person at this location to do that? Or could it be a tenant that happens to be under a preponderance of this?
City Attorney Choi.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I'll take it kind of through how this might work. If you start at Section 2, that is the substance of the cause of action, which would essentially, by legislative declaration, you are saying that as an example, under Subdivision 1, you are saying that a criminal gang as defined above, which is 609.229, that definition as defined by Minnesota statutes states that a criminal gang means any organization, association, or group of three or more persons, whether formal or informal, for the primary activity of commissions of offenses that are listed under 609.11. That statute are essentially the Part 1 serious crime. So you first have to prove that by a preponderance of the evidence. Secondly, you would have to prove that gang activities, as defined in the statute, would have occurred by a preponderance of the evidence and continuously and regularly, which means five times over the course of a 12-month period. And what we're talking about is the commission. Now, the reality of what if there is a – for instance, if let's say there are five – activities that actually occurred, and those were felony types of prosecutions, and they were still pending. The reality is that probably nothing. We would not be doing anything under this law because we would not want to interfere with a current felony investigation. But if there were an instance where it would be appropriate to move forward, I think it could be used in a very powerful way.
Yeah. Senator Limmer, and just for the other members too, it's been pointed out to me that the cross-reference statutes are all included with the summary that we have. Mm-hmm. If you want to reference any of these. Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, Mr. Choi, would it have to be the same three or more individuals to trigger the five or more separate incidences within 12-month period?
City Attorney Choi?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, what we're trying to do is we're trying to go after gang activity. Yeah. So one of the elements of the substance of this cause of action would be to prove that these individual defendants were, in fact, a member of a criminal gang. That is one of the elements that you would have to prove.
I know what you're trying to get at, Madam Chair, but if you had, you know, individual A, B, and C, commit a crime, and then next month individual A and C commit a crime, then you can't really count that one because it's not the same three or more. I'm just trying to second guess how effective can we observe and determine who committed some of these crimes outlined, and be an effective bill that turns into law that can be enforced. I hope it can be done.
Senator Moy, and I would just comment, too, that might be a discussion that we could have in a broader sense at another time. But, Senator Moy?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, there are many, many members in one gang.
Right.
And in the instance of Subdivision 1, where we're going after the gang and the gang activities, I think the threshold proof is just so long as it doesn't matter which members, so long as they have membership in the one gang. So if you've got, you know, 50 gang members, you know, at one time it could be gang member number 1 and number 4 and number 5. Another instance might be gang number 6, number 7, member number 6, 7, 12, but they're still in one gang engaging in gang activities with that membership. I think that definition, though, changes when you go to the place. It could be one, you know, activity with one gang, the red group, and then a separate with the blue group, and a separate with the purple group, and that would constitute in the place. So I would think it depends on whether you're looking at going after the gang members and their gang activities, or if you're looking at going after the place where the gang activity is taking place.
Senator Limmer, does that answer your concern?
For now, it does.
Okay.
I did have another question, though.
Okay, Senator Limmer.
Senator Moy, on page 1, line 19, you make reference to, at the very end of the sentence, and this is directed at the individual who controls or owns the property, the land surrounding the place. And was there a limit to how far that extends out beyond the place?
Senator
Ma?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I did raise that question, and the reason why I left it as that is because if you're the property owner, technically you really only have jurisdiction over what you own. So the legal property boundaries is really all that you're responsible for. And if it happens in your neighbor's lot and you get hit for it, you can say, I don't own that because it's not part of what I own.
And Senator Moy, Senator Limmer, just I'm also noticing, and Ms. Pontius is pointing out to me that on line 114 and 115, there is a little bit more language that more closely defines what we're talking about, and I'm sure that would be the meaning given to the same phrase used just a few lines later.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm thinking of
Senator Limmer.
I'm thinking of a group of kids that hang out on a street corner, and they might hang out at a particular corner all the time. It's rather territorial, and yet they can walk on the sidewalk, they can walk on the front yard, they can walk in the street, in the gutter of the street, maybe go across the street, but they kind of hang out underneath the one street lamp all the time. And if the action just happens to happen off the curb, that would negate
any action on the part of a city attorney?
Senator Ma, our city attorney.
Well, I think the intention here, first of all, the definition of place is really modeled after, if you just change the word place and made it into business, or the definition was business, it's actually it's the same, pretty much the same language as 617.80, which is the other public nuisance statute that we already have in statute, and that's been litigated pretty frequently in the state. But to answer your question, I think what we're trying to get at is the land surrounding the structure, and then if you read the next two phrases, it's under the control of the person who owns or is responsible for maintaining the structure. So I think what we're trying to do is if we're talking about the land surrounding the structure, I think what we're talking about is that land or that area that is in control of the person or the defendant who would be getting sued, not like the public sidewalk, because I don't think that a private landowner or building owner would be in control of the public sidewalk. However, maybe the parking lot behind the premise, perhaps.
So the attorney,
I've owned property in Minneapolis before, and if it's in the middle of winter, the city makes sure that you're reminded that you are responsible for the sidewalk and the clearing of it. Otherwise, you'll be penalized. Mm-hmm. So in that case, maybe not in St. Paul, but in Minneapolis, that owner is responsible for that public pathway. And that's, you know, maybe I'm parsing it too tight, but it certainly would be available, an available tool. One more available tool to take care of problem properties or problem gang activity in an area. And it puts a little responsibility on the owner to say, if this activity is going on, cancel your lease and get rid of these guys.
Senator
Ma? If they're at 10.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, if I understand your question, and I think what I'd like to do is have a conversation with these guys to see how we can fit in the sidewalk issue. I don't think that it's the intention is not that you be held responsible for the activities that are happening under the streetlight and, you know, your particular corner of the sidewalk. I think those activities, if they're occurring under public land, we'll go after them for the gang activities, you know, that are taking place for the group injunction as opposed to putting it on you. But I'll make sure that I do that clarification and touch base with you on this if you're willing to let it go for now. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, and I guess this is a question for Mr. Choi. Did you think about putting in the 617.81, the nuisance, the list of acts constituting a nuisance gang activity?
Mr. Choi?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, actually we did, and we wrestled with that because it, just to make it cleaner, it would be better to put it under one statute. However, there are some differences. First of all, the standard by which under 617.80 is clear and convincing evidence. That has been, to some extent, a barrier to some of the cases that we have moved forward with because a lot of times a prosecution may still be pending at the county. Therefore, all we have access to are public police reports, and we can include them by affidavit testimony, but it's that clear and convincing standard has been somewhat of a kind of a hurdle for us under 617.80. Secondly, if you look carefully at 617.80, that public nuisance statute, it really is targeted at landlords and kind of buildings, because if you look at, I'll just quote from the statute, but under 617.81, which defines what nuisances are, under subdivision 2, all of that is, prostitution, gambling, unlicensed sale of alcohol, beverages, guns, all that kind of stuff. But after every element or after every act that might constitute a nuisance, and there's a number of them that are listed under the statute, they all say within the building. And what we're trying to get at here is not under this gang injunction statute is not only to maybe enjoin the use of a place, but also to just get at criminal gang activities. And just by illustration, orders like in California and in Texas, and ones that have been upheld by the courts in both of these states, would enjoin, for instance, let's say if there are 15 defendants in the lawsuit who are all members of a criminal gang, the order would enjoin these 15 individuals from essentially hanging out with each other, because if they were seen together, a police officer would then have probable cause to arrest them. Another example in an order that has been used would be to draw a, if the gang has been causing significant problems, let's say at a school, to say that these 15 individuals who are defendants in this lawsuit cannot be in this particular zone in and around the school. So that typically those are the types of things that would be put into an order by a judge after an evidentiary hearing on the record.
Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, if there are no more further questions, I'd like to move Senate File 493.
Senator Moore, before you do that, I just wanted to point out that we never quite completed the discussion about the sign in front of the structure. I don't think we had a motion on that.
Madam Chair, I don't think it was a motion. I thought it was just a suggestion. And
okay.
Since we didn't take it as a motion, I didn't think that we would have to
No, there hasn't. You're right, Senator Ma. There hasn't been a motion. I just wanted to make sure that you want it to move forward as it stands, because we kind of went away from that discussion again. So,
Madam Chair, based on the feedback from members of the committee, I prefer that we move forward with it without that additional language.
Thank you, Senator Ma. Senator Betzel?
I do have a question based upon the discussion on that Mr. Choi mentioned, that the nuisance law currently requires a standard of clear and convincing evidence. I'm not quite sure. Does it say in this bill what the standard is? Because it does. I'm sorry.
It's the other one.
Where does it say what the standard is?
John says.
Because it does say that. Well, it establishes a prima facie case in the level of evidence. But I don't know that a court, is it possible that a court might still say, well, yes, but since we don't define it, if you look on page 2, line 2.3, it says, who's conducted the public news?
Senator Betzel, Ms. Pontius is telling me that because it isn't defined, it's probably would be assumed to be preponderance of the evidence.
Right.
And seems that Mr. Choi is in agreement with that.
Okay. I'll raise the question that, given the fact that we have a separate nuisance standard on the books, is it possible that the courts could look to their for guidance and say, well, in other instances, a nuisance is requires clear and convincing evidence. This is also nuisance, and so they might see a nexus between them.
Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, if either Senator Betzel or Ms. Pontius could help me actually put that in the language, that would make me very happy.
Put what in?
Which one?
And Madam Chair, while Ms. Pontius is looking for a way to do that, I have somebody here from the Multi-Housing Association who would like to speak on the bill.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Todd Liljenquist. I'm with Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. I'll be very brief. I'd simply like to say that we support this bill, and we appreciate the author's efforts in working with us.
Madam Chair and members, I did tell members of this committee that we should work out our bills with the stakeholders, and I am so happy to have this witness sitting next to me on this bill.
Where does this go next? Us?
There's probably going to be some.
Okay.
Is this a misdemeanor?
It's a new crime.
Misdemeanor or crime?
It doesn't have to.
Senator Moore, are you ready to hear language?
I am, and I'd like to move that language.
Okay. On page 2, line 19, the amendment would read, if the court finds comma, by a preponderance of the evidence, comma, that a criminal gang constitutes a public nuisance, and so forth. And then on line 27, the same change, if the court finds, comma, and then insert by a preponderance of the evidence, comma, that a place is continuously or regularly used, and so forth. That would be, is that amendment sufficient or agreeable with you, Senator Moi?
Madam Chair, that amendment is completely agreeable to me.
Senator Moi moves that amendment. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Now, Senator Moi, are you ready to move your bill?
I'm ready to move the bill, Madam Chair. I'd like to move that Senate File 493, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to
The floor.
Unless Senator Foley wants to see it, but I don't think he does.
We'd be delighted to have you.
Senator Foley, do you need the bill? Okay. Senator Moi moves that Senate File 493 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the floor.
Just discussion, Madam Chair. We don't want to send Senator Foley's budget division because Senator Moi may try to vote on it again. As she did yesterday on a bill. Not a member of the budget division.
All in favor? Senator Neville.
Good work. Let me ask one more question just to delay it. To get it on the record, Section 6 of the bill allows award of attorney's fees to a prevailing party. I presume that means that if you bring a case and the owner prevails, you're going to pay his attorney's fees, too. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and members,
Senator
yes.
Moi?
It's intended to go both ways.
Yes.
Okay.
Prevailing.
Thanks.
Okay. Senator Moi renews her motion. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Adjourned.